Hey guys, you've got TJ Pura, and I'm really happy to be on the Players and Payers podcast.
Welcome to the Payers and Players podcast, episode number 50. Please follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Our handle is Payers Players. To contact us, we can be reached at payersandplayers@gmail.com. Also, you can visit our website for our show notes, research, and picture video archive of many of today's top players and rising stars. The website address is www.payersandplayers.com. We're really excited about this episode today with TJ Pura, who you may remember from episode number 11. In our last podcast with Tommy Paul, Tommy credited TJ for helping him regain his confidence and how instrumental TJ was in Tommy having a breakout year where he reached a career high of number 79. So we thought it'd be interesting to hear from TJ and tell us his perspective on their relationship, as well as catching up with him on what he's doing now. So as you guys know, we're really big fans of the documentary 50,000 Balls, which TJ was part of and his dad produced. So what we're going to do is we're going to offer a personally signed DVD by TJ to one lucky listener. All you have to do is retweet this episode on Twitter or on Instagram. You can like it and tag two friends or put it on your story or share it on Facebook. For any one of those things you do, you'll get one entry into the drawing and we'll announce the winner in January. Also, we have some great interviews coming up that we want to share with you. We'll be talking with Peyton Stearns, who's one of the female top recruits in the country. Jack Newman is the founder of the Austin Tennis Academy. We'll also be talking with Matt Rowe, who was one of Tommy's coaches growing up, and we'll hear about his development story. We'll also talk to Adam Blitcher, who has a great podcast you may be aware of. And finally, after the Australian Open, we'll be talking with JJ Wolf. So please stay tuned and look forward to those episodes.
So TJ, as you may have heard, we had an opportunity to talk with Tommy Paul while we were in Knoxville. And one of the questions I asked him was, you know, because when I last saw you, TJ, was in Champaign and you were with Tommy there coaching. And since then, Tommy's really, you know, taken off in terms of his ranking. It's gone from, you know, the 300s to the top 80. And so I sort of mentioned that, you know, I think that, you know, you being with him in Champaign really kickstarted his rise up the rankings. And what he told me was actually, that's probably a lot, there's a lot of truth to that. And he said that, you know, you've been with him for a few months. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your relationship with Tommy and how you guys got together and what you did with him during that period to help, you know, get him on this, on the path to where he is right now.
Absolutely, Scott, happy to. You know, to be perfectly honest, to begin with, working with Tommy has been one of the biggest pleasures of my life. Kid is just positive all around. And to see the kind of growth as a tennis player, but really more as a person, that, you know, over the 6 months that we were together working closely every day, and then over the past 12 to 18 months where we've been apart, but getting to see, it's been tremendous, you know, totally tremendous, and the pleasure of a lifetime. So, you know, to begin, I guess the story with Tommy and I, we met briefly while I was at Duke. Obviously, he's from Greenville, so he came by to hang out with some of his younger buddies, and we met briefly in North Carolina. But when I was training down in Orlando at the USTA, I remember having lunch with Mackie and Tommy, and this was my first day. I'd just gotten in. And Mackie's like, hey, where are you staying tonight? I'm like, oh, I'm just going to crash on like an Airbnb couch or, you know, Motel 6, like find something. And Tommy's like, dude, I have a 2-bedroom apartment. Like, come stay with me. So, and that was just for a week. It was basically a trial week at USTA. So I stayed with Tommy, like literally first night we hit it off. And then I ended up, while I was training down there, we lived together. And then my tennis career got cut a little bit short due to injuries and really wasn't sure what my next step was. And Tommy was just coming back from taking 6 months off with an elbow injury and was really, you know, ready and motivated to kind of make a turn, and not only motivated on the tennis court, but really to kind of grow as a person. And I think that always have had the belief that if you help someone as a person, they're going to become a better tennis player. So with Tommy, it was really mental toughness to begin with, focused on, hey man, like, sure, everyone knows you're talented, but I don't want you to be just the talent story. I want you to be a bulldog out there. and compete for every single point. And I'd seen glimpses of it, but it really wasn't as consistent as, you know, I would have liked, or I know he would have liked. But that takes a lot of mental effort and a lot of fortitude every single point. And, you know, Tommy over 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, I feel like he's turned that into part of his game that he brings every single day, to where he's on the court and his opponent is like, man, shoot, I got a battle on my hands here. You know, I'm playing Tommy Paul. The guy runs for every ball. He never gets down on himself. All positive attitude. Like, and he's an incredibly good tennis player on top of all that. So I think that was probably the most marked shift for him, was in terms of being a bulldog every single point. And I think the, you know, the rise in the rankings is a result of that, and a result of him really taking his professionalism to the next level. I remember him being incredibly disciplined in terms of his nutrition, in terms of working out, in terms of stretching, and just overall having an open mind about different ways to improve. And I would say, hey, TP, give this a shot. He'd be like, hey, absolutely. It wouldn't work. We'd be like, okay, let's go back to the drawing board. Give this a shot. He's like, ooh, I like that. That worked really well for me. And then we kind of build from there. Just, you know, you're stacking building blocks when you're trying to improve and you're playing tennis and it's such a long game. You know, if you can get 0.1% or 0.05% better each day, that is huge. And it could be, you know, maybe you don't have a good day on the tennis court, but you're like, hey, you know what? I'm going to make stretching a part of my routine. I'm going to do 15 minutes of stretching every day after practice. That's probably better than anything you could do on the tennis court if you commit to it for a long term. So long-winded answer, but that was kind of my general philosophy with Tommy. And, you know, I think the results have spoken for themselves, and I hope they continue to.
Yes. Okay, let me ask you this. As I watch the top 150 players in the world, how much do you think the difference between number 140 and number 70 is just desire and effort?
That's a really good question. I'd say you're splitting hairs at that point in terms of tennis. So I think it really comes down to you know, mental toughness, fitness, and, you know, how badly you want it. And, you know, in TP's case, that guy was crazy hungry for 2019. I mean, so hungry. He had a bitter taste in his mouth about 2018, about his injury, and he came back for the 2018 season, and he came back and he just went full throttle. And, you know, was playing 8-9 weeks in a row, going qualies, three setters all the way through finals, winning challengers. I mean, putting a ton of stress on his body. Generally every week he was dealing with some sort of an ailment, you know, nothing so serious, but still he was fighting through pain. And that was something I'm, again, incredibly proud of. And I think, you know, the TP of January 2018 was a different person than the TP of November 2018, and definitely the different TP of, you know, now we're in December 2019. It's all just been really a real kick to observe and be a part of.
Yeah. I think you hit the nail on the head when you said that, you know, each day you're just trying to get, you know, half of 1% better. And when you do that over, you know, 365 days, those gains are, it's just sort of like that compound interest. The gains are just phenomenal from where you started. So, you know, and I think, you know, the way that, you know, Tommy and Riley, when we saw them there in Champaign, you could sort of tell that they were hungry and ready to get out of the challengers. They were, knew that their game was, you know, ready for the next level, and they were just ready to go. And so I'm so glad to see both of them, you know, getting there. And hopefully, you know, 2020 will be really good for both of them, and they can, you know, the hardest part, you know, is I should say it's the other way around. It's so hard to break into the top 100, and to stay there is, you know, will be a challenge, but, you know, getting there is a real battle because it's so hard to break in. So hopefully 2020 will be that, you know, something where they can solidify where they are.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, like you said, I mean, the challengers are really tough, really, really, really tough. And once you get into the top 100, sure, things become a little bit easier. It becomes a little bit easier on your body. You're less stressed to play as many tournaments, But in terms of a level and in terms of the margins, they just continue to compress. And, you know, the difference between, 50 and 100 in the world is so small that it's all the more important and critical to keep striving for those 0.01% improvements, you know, or the 0.5% improvements. And to really never lose faith, which, you know, I think in TP's case, look, to be perfectly honest, there were some really tough times. I remember being at Aptos, traveled out to Aptos from the comfort of Durham at the time. I had about a week off and went hung out with my girlfriend at the time and went out to Aptos to be the TP, and TP tanked first round against Giron, lost 3-0. And I remember sitting down with him. We sat down in the bed of our rental pickup truck for like 2 hours, might have had a couple glasses of wine in there. And we had a serious heart to heart because I was like, look, TP, I love you, man. I want to work with you. It's a huge, huge, huge pleasure to be with you. But I'm giving 100% here, and you cannot look me in the eye today and tell me you gave anything even close to 100%. So what am I doing here? You know, if I'm given 100 and you're given 75, 80, I'll tell you right now, this isn't going to work, and let's save each other the pain. And I think, you know, that was a big wake up call, for him. And I think it was not because he was afraid of losing me, but it was more like, you know, here's a guy who cares so much, and really, really wants the best for me and believes in me, that I think he realized he needed to believe a little bit more in himself. And I definitely think he's done that. And I think he's continuing to find more and more belief, in himself every day.
And do you guys continue to, I know that you're no longer, on the road and everything, but do you guys, keep in touch on a regular basis and, does he consult with you, or how is that relationship today?
Yeah. We stay in touch. I mean, a kid that, he's a little brother I never had. But we probably text like every day or every other day. A lot of times it's like, hey bro, I miss you, hope you're doing well. And then anytime that he's playing, even if I'm at the office, you better believe that I have the live stream up. And I think pretty much all my coworkers know who Tommy Paul is because they've seen me in front of a laptop, being like, let's go. Or like, no, why did I get a shot? getting animated. So super close. Actually was texting him like probably 30 minutes ago. So,
Awesome.
Well, TJ, can you tell us your current situation, what you're doing right now? Give us a little update.
Yeah, absolutely. So very different than being on the tennis court. I'm actually I'm an investment banking analyst here in New York City at a bank called Jefferies. And I work specifically focused on the power, utilities, and infrastructure space. To give you the backstory there, it's not like growing up, even in high school or college, even though both my parents were in finance, I didn't really see myself in finance at the time. I studied computer science in college and was more interested in kind of like the product and engineering and tech side of things. But as I kind of grew and matured and realized kind of, what I want to be doing in 10, 15 years when I'm 30, 35, 40, recognizing that it's not going to be on the tennis court, I really want to make an impact on the world. And like we're talking about with tennis, you don't do that overnight. But I wanted to do something impactful, and kind of work myself there. One of the biggest ways that I see, the next decade and two decades, three decades changing is with energy and infrastructure and power. So I kind of, we have very aggressive renewable portfolio standards across the country, across the world, and I want to be a part of the solution, and ultimately work to a place where, we're installing solar panels at all across the globe, and we're driving electric vehicles, and we're reducing greenhouse gases in any way possible, and creating new infrastructure that's saving people time and saving people energy, and overall improving the quality of life. So that's not actually when I moved to New York. I came to New York in about a year ago, so December 2018, without a job. And I thought I was going to go into sports management, having worked with Tommy and kind of being his manager, coach, mentor. And then kind of what I just explained became pretty apparent to me. And then it was like, okay, what's this first step there? And basically like the buds of, using the Navy SEAL analogy, but the buds of finance is investment banking. And you start as an analyst and you're the one, you know, working close to 100 hours a week, and just like grinding away. And I was really, really ready for that. And I was actually motivated by that. And I knew that the experience with tennis, not having studied finance in college, not having done the banking internships that a bunch of people had done during college, and being, you know, if we're talking about competitively, being on paper, not even close to the candidate of a guy next to me who maybe studied econ and then did a banking job at Goldman Sachs and, you know, his junior year and then once he went to finance, I took a totally different approach. I bootstrapped my way in. I was taking day and night classes, day classes online, learning advanced Excel and PowerPoint. And then at night, I was taking classes in financial modeling, accounting, and financial statement analysis. So did that for about 2 months. All the while, I was just like networking my butt off, and ultimately got an opportunity to interview at Jefferies. And my pitch to them was like, look, if you're looking for some Jedi whiz who can model with his eyes closed, I'm not your guy. I'll tell you, I'll save you the 30 minutes right now. You can kick me out of the room. But if you're looking for a guy who's going to come in every single day with a growth mentality, he's going to try to get better every single day. He's going to want to learn from his mistakes, and he's going to give 100%, and he's not going to stop until the job is done, then don't interview anyone else. And it ended up working pretty well. I got the job offer the next day and never really looked back.
Awesome.
So it's been a good experience.
That's fantastic. And I wish that I know that I'll have my son listen to this because I think that
absolutely
answer was really inspirational, and I think every kid should hear that. That was fantastic. I'm curious.
Go ahead, Scott. Let me do set the stage real quick. So TJ, it's 9:30 Eastern as we are recording this podcast. And tell us just where you're sitting and where you're recording from.
Yeah, so I'm sitting in the office right now at 53rd Street and Madison Avenue in New York City. It's 9:30, so it's still early. I think I've probably got another 2-3 hours in the office. Maybe try to sneak out for a quick workout in about an hour if I can. Generally work at a minimum probably 9 to 10:30, on average closer to 9 to 11:30. And then, you know, you get some 3, 4, 5 a.m.ers sprinkled in there, which are always fun. But it's like anything. It's like when you go through something tough, when you're in it, you're like, shoot, man, this kind of sucks, yep. Right? Like you're in the mud, but you get through it. Yep. And then you wake up the next day and you're like, you know what? I just did that. Like, heck yeah. Yes. I can do that again. Absolutely. And I will do it again. And next time I'm facing that situation, it's going to be easier because I've already done it. And you just keep building. It's like getting a high, heavy ball to your backhand. You know, for me, it's like first high, heavy moon balls I got to my backhand, I was like, oh my God, what are these? This is going to crumble my tennis career.
And you're a one-handed backhand. So it's even worse.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Then you're like, okay, you know what? Let me step in on it. Step in. You shank the first 4,000. And then eventually you hit one clean. You're like, oh man, okay, that's how it feels. And then you keep going, and you keep going, and you keep going to the point where it's like, you know what? Give me a high, heavy back end. You know, I like that. I want the adversity. I want the challenge.
TJ, tell me this. Were you always process oriented and growth mindset oriented, or were you very, I see kids usually are one or the other, and was it always in your tennis career and your academic career that you were, hey, slow and steady wins the race, I'll eventually get there? Or were you very results oriented and had to learn to become more growth mindset oriented?
Yeah, definitely something that I had to learn. over time. I guess to give you the background, the results were drilled into me from an early age from both my parents, but especially my dad. I mean, he was a trader on Wall Street, fast-paced guy. I mean, no one could keep up with him. And I remember he would drop me off at school and he would say straight A's or bust. And then at tennis, you know, if I played well, he was happy. And if I didn't play well, a lot of times he was upset. Having said that, he did always stress the controllables. He said, you control what you can control, you know, your feet, your mind, your heart, your attitude. And you let the rest take care of itself. Where he faltered a little bit was even if you had a, you know, good mind and good heart and good feet, but you played terrible and you lost 2-2, like, he was pissed. And I was pissed too. So when I was young, I'd say it was pretty tough to get out of that results oriented mentality. And even going into late junior tennis and in college, like, look, when I get out on the court, I don't want to beat around the bush. Like, I wanted to win. And that's why I went out. And that's, like, I love competing.
Sure.
I love
beating
the person across from me more than anything. What I realized in my kind of the last, like, 3-4 years of my tennis career is, all right, the way that I'm going to win and the way that I'm going to get there is by following the process and by doing things, you know, step by step and not worrying about, okay, I have a match, you know, tomorrow that I need to win. Like, no, you know what? Continue doing what you're doing, and you're going to peak when you want to peak. And when you're planning on it, and use tomorrow, if you're working on something, use that match as an opportunity to work on it. Or maybe it's not a match, because I kind of say that if you're in a match, you got to do whatever you need to do to get the job done. But if it's a practice match, for example, like, I wasn't playing to win practice matches. I was playing to work on my game. And so that way, when I got to the real deal, I didn't have to worry about, okay, you know, technique or strategy or anything. It was already ingrained. So long-winded answer, I would say that, you know, you can totally have a combination of both, and all the greats, sure, they're really, really good at the process, but man, they hate losing. I was watching, I remember watching Tiger's 2000 US Open performance. They called it the Pebble Beach, you know, perfection at Pebble Beach. And he was going for the record on Sunday at the US Open. He had like an 8-stroke lead going into the final round. What was his goal? It was, I'm not going to make a bogey today. That was his only goal. That's the only thing he cared about. And that was the game plan he executed. And he ended up not making a bogey. He sunk like 2 huge 12-footers for par. And you could see, even though the field was like 11, 12, 13 strokes behind, like, he still held himself to that really high standard. And I think that's what elite athletes, and elite people in general, no matter what you're doing, is they kind of try to hold themselves to a higher standard than others.
Yeah, that's good
absolutely
stuff.
Absolutely agree to that. Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. You know, and I think that's one of the things that, you know, like with Federer at a young age, you know, he was a very good player, but his temper was, you know, not what it is now. But it is because he had that expectation and those standards. And when he wasn't achieving that, you know, he was frustrated. He didn't know how to deal with it. He learned that later. But, you know, all those greats have that super high standards for themselves. And that's why it's, you know, for as parents, you know, we sort of struggle with how do we deal with our kids that, you know, when they are struggling in practice, and, you know, my son shanks a couple of balls in a row, then he starts yelling. And it was just practice. But, you know, at the same time, you want him to have that standard, but that I'm not the one that's telling him, you know, stop shanking or, you know, focus, get your head down or whatever. He's the one that's got to have the internal drive to be passionate about making those balls. And it has to come with it from within, but it's often an ugly process on, you know, how you get there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, really.
Absolutely. And I think another point, I think you bring up a really good one, is that, you know, as a tennis player, no matter the age, you really want to be able to internalize that drive and that mental toughness and that focus as much as you can. However, just the reality of it is when you're 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, like you don't know what's going on. You don't really understand. Like you need a, in my opinion, you need a parent there to be the hard driver and to say, hey, TJ, or hey, Luke, dude, they're like, no, wake up. You throw your racket again, I'm pulling you out of practice. You know, or you put your head down, like, that's it, we're not going to practice for a couple of days. And then, you know, I know how much both your boys love tennis. Like, I'm sure that would eat away at them more than, you know, any other kind of lesson. So I think that it's definitely something that as they get older and they mature, yes, the ability to internalize that grows. But at a young age, I think it is super important for parents to, especially, you know, you guys get it. So then it's almost your job as parents to educate your kids, because look, at 11, 12 years old, they're not going to have it all figured out, and that's totally okay. And they're not expected to. So right. You can kind of guide them, and then you'll see it happen. There'll be some flashes of it at 12, 13, you know, a little bit more at 14, 15, 16. And then hopefully by the time they're, you know, a young adult, it's like, that's how they are. And that's, again, yeah. It's just reps. It's just doing that every day over and over. Yeah.
Well, and, yep. You know, I work with teachers a lot. One of the things I talk about is teachers want the traditional teacher wants the students to sit down, be quiet, and listen to the teacher. And mm-hmm. And research will tell you that's not the most effective way to teach a child. Often when you have an environment that is organized, but what I call messy, that's mm-hmm. the most effective way to get kids to learn at their own pace. And sometimes in a group clinic or an academy setting, you'll see a coach with a player who's fiery or emotional, and that messiness, it bothers parents. You know, the parents are all sitting around and they're going, well, if my kid did that, right? And so a little bit of an acceptance that kid's 10 or 11 and they're trying to learn how to do exactly what you're talking about, and it's not going to happen when they're 10 or 11. Right. I mean, when I go to a high level tournament, there's let's goes and there's crying and there's freaking out and there's breaking rackets and there's all kind of behavior. Right.
Oh, yeah.
And the parents are generally responding just like they should. When the kid comes off the court, they're not happy and they're having a discussion with them and they're encouraging them to do better next time and doing just like you said. Maybe we're going to take a week off tennis, whatever, you know, or take their phone or whatever the punishment for that individual child is.
Yeah, I guess taking the phone nowadays, that's like the ultimate.
That's the thing, man.
Yeah, that's their life. Yeah,
that's the ultimate punishment right there.
Well, the bottom line is, and I used to say this all the time when I coached football, is I saw kids cry. I saw kids cuss. I saw them grab each other's areas you wouldn't want to name. But but the fans couldn't see it or hear it. The difference in tennis is I can see and hear everything you say and do. And so parents are like, oh my gosh, I can't believe they said that, right? But in football, they can't hear any of it, right? And it's much nastier than it is in tennis. But I love what you're basically describing is that journey from 10 to 18 to become who they're going to become. It's nasty along the way. It's not clean.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And you know, I think that's life too, right? Like, we kind of all have this idyllic sense in our mind that life should go in a straight line and it should be linear. And you go and you improve and you go a step forward.
Right.
But that's just not the reality. Life's a freaking roller coaster, right? And it's going to throw curveballs at you and they're going to hit you in the face sometimes and they're going to knock you on your butt and you're going to have no idea at first how you respond. And you're going to think the world is coming down and you're going to, you know, you have the worst thoughts go through your head. But when the dust settles and the tears dry, you look and you say, okay, you know what? What am I going to do in this moment to put myself on the right track? I'm not going to solve the problem right here, but I can make a choice to do something that's positive and that's beneficial. And that's all you can do, because the curveballs are going to come. You're going to keep getting hit by pitches, whether you're 12, whether you're 18, whether you're 24, whether you're 50. You know, the going doesn't get any easier. It's just that you get tougher along the way.
Yeah. So TJ, you know, one of the things that, you know, parents will always say is one of the reasons they like their kids playing tennis is because the life lessons they learn through junior development and junior, you know, just the journey, as we've talked about. But I'm curious, you know, how did that come up at all in your interview process when you were looking for a job? How was your tennis career viewed by, say, your current employer or other people that you interviewed with?
Great question.
Yeah. You know, I think it's always definitely been a positive, in the sense that I think when an employer or someone that you meet in general recognizes that you've already dedicated, you know, hundreds of thousands of hours to a single craft.
Or at least 50,000 balls, right?
Right. At least 50,000 balls at a bare minimum.
That's a low number.
Yeah, exactly. 50, you know, we were already there at 11 with 50,000, but you know, I think it's a huge positive. And like you don't notice it as much when everything's good, right? Like mm-hmm. when everything's good, you can't tell an athlete from a non-athlete. However, what I will say is that when things are tough, and you see this around the office, when things are tough, mm-hmm. you can kind of tell the people who have worked on a team or who have faced serious adversity versus those who haven't.
Interesting.
That's good stuff. Apparent.
Yeah, so I think that employers recognize that to a degree. Sure, they focus a lot on GPA and what school you went to and all that. I think probably more than they necessarily should. But hey, that's the way the world works, and you know, that's totally fine. There's always going to be an element of that. But I think that when you start looking at the intangibles and, you know, you see an athlete, if I were an employer or when I am an employer someday, I'm definitely not going to hire exclusively athletes, but, I'd want to hire just individuals who have dedicated, a lot to a certain craft or have had to overcome some serious adversity. And that, you know, you could have never played a sport in your life, but if you've gone through some rough stuff in your life and you're still coming out on top and you still have a positive attitude and you're still looking forward on ways to improve, like, that's just going to translate into work, right? Like, that doesn't go away.
Right.
So, you know, I think for me, it's been a big positive. I think it's what's made me get to be somewhat successful in my role right now. I mean, I'm 9 months or 10 months in. And improving every day, and far from perfect. But if I look at where I was like 9 months ago, I get pretty pumped up. I'm like, man, you didn't know anything 9 months ago. And now like, I know next to nothing. No, I'm just kidding. But, you guys know what I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, one of the things, TJ, that I always tell my son is enjoy it when it gets hard, right? I mean, most people, when it gets hard, they sort of avoid it. And I always talk to them about if you're in your match and it gets hard, just kind of breathe in and enjoy it. You know, when you're in class and the content gets hard, that's when it's fun. I notice kids really struggle with that. And what I'm enjoying about hearing about your conversation is you entered this job knowing nothing, as you said, but you watch the other employees around you, and when the going gets hard, you can tell the difference in the athletes and the non-athletes. What is a way that kind of you can express to a young kid that it really is more fun when it's difficult? I mean, I think about when I'm at work and I have a difficult problem, I really enjoy that more when I'm in the middle of that and I'm not bored, right? But in a tennis match, how do you catch yourself in the middle of a match that's difficult and just think to yourself, man, I'm enjoying this rather than miserable? Because I see some of these high-level players that are playing a match and they just can't wait to get off the court. You know, whether they win or lose, they're just trying to get off the court so they can get out of that situation. And I watch some of the best players in the world, and when it's difficult, they seem to enjoy it the most. right? And so how do you kind of teach that, or what's your experience on when you kind of had that moment where you said, man, this is hard and I'm enjoying it. I'm not avoiding it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of it comes down to messaging and to, you know, the things that I was lucky that my parents instilled in me from an early age. But it was when things were tough, like, hey, that was the time to dig in. Why? Because that's when you learn something about yourself. That's when you grow. You don't grow in the easy moments, all that. You're kind of like floating in the easy moments. You're growing when your back's up against the wall and you have no idea what to do, and you try something that you didn't think was going to work and it works, and you're like, oh man, that was awesome. Like, and it feels so much better. Like, I love nothing more than playing a tournament first round, have an absolute battle, go three sets, and you see, you know, the tournament flash before your eyes, and you're down a set in a break, and then you're like, no, this is a good part, because I'm going to, like, this is an opportunity for me to come back in the first round and then go and win the tournament. And then you do it, and then you're beyond fired up. You're like, have seen a totally different side of yourself that you didn't know you had before, and you have a different gear. And then you just keep building on that, and it builds confidence, and it builds resilience, and it builds this level of like fire in you that, and you know, in people in general, that I think is really dangerous, you know, and like, if you're not dangerous for the person, but dangerous for your opponents. Cause then they're going to come out on the court and be like, shoot, man, you know, I know there's nothing that can throw this guy off mentally, so I just need to outplay him today. And that's a lot of pressure to put on an opponent, to be like, hey,
right,
got to all come down to tennis, you know, like, you need to beat me on the court, because everything else, everything intangible, like, hey, I'm better at that than you, not because I'm talented at mental toughness, but because I've worked at it every single day. And well, there's so many times.
Go ahead. You know, the thing is, I look at a guy like Federer, and the things that other people view as work, he seems to enjoy, right? I mean, the grind of the traveling and the nutrition and the stretching and the fitness and the weight and the practice and the matches, it doesn't appear, and I think the fact that he hasn't retired shows you that, it appears like he enjoys it when it's hard, where other guys retire at 28 because they just got sick of what they call the grind. You see what I'm saying? And yeah, I think it's almost a mentality that I really like this, and other people don't, right?
Right. Exactly. You gotta love to dig in when things are tough.
We really hope you enjoyed episode 50 of the Payers and Players podcast as much as we enjoyed recording it. TJ's an awesome young person, really great role model for young tennis players, but also non-tennis players. It was so fun to get to hear how tennis has impacted his life off the court in the business world. Also, if you would, go back to the beginning of the podcast and you can listen to how to enter our contest to win the autographed DVD of 50,000 Balls. Once again, thanks for listening to episode 50. We hope you enjoyed.